From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And today there are screenings for everything from skin cancer to hypertension and much, much more. Is that all good medicine? Not according to one Harvard-trained MD. Tonight on Point, one doctor's provocative prescription for a healthier America through less medical intervention. But first, we begin tonight in New York City with a preview of the long-anticipated recommendations of a federal panel charged with investigating the collapse of the World Trade Center. The panel's proposals, due out tomorrow, are intended to influence policies on evacuation strategies for tall buildings nationwide. Early drafts of the recommendation sparked opposition to the tough demands it would place on future development projects. Jim Dwyer has been covering the story for the New York Times and joins me now. Welcome, Jim.
Good evening.
So quickly, what did the investigation find?
They found that through a lot of recreation of precisely what led to the collapse of the towers, the mechanism by which the building failed, but I think the most important issues that emerged from this study, which is like a 10,000-page autopsy of the Trade Center in its final minutes, was the way the materials and the people behave, the structure itself, and how the humans acted when they were faced with this calamity. And the results were very enlightening because it showed that a lot of the benchmarks used in the design of buildings, whether it was how fast people could get down the stairs or how long certain kinds of steel could stand up to fire, proved to be inadequate. They just proved to be wrong, actually. They were tested by these events. And so one of the things that this federal investigation, which was conducted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, has decided to do was say, look, you need to change or recognize that the benchmarks don't reflect reality.
Well, and also it was a chilling reminder that as awful as that day was, it could have been even worse if the buildings had been fully filled, that there could have been 12,000 lives lost. But let me ask you about
additional lives.
Additional, yeah. Right. If the builders of the World Trade Center had followed these recommendations, if they had been in place at the time the centers were built, would that day have been different?
It's hard to know. Some of these recommendations are not prescriptions per se. For instance, one of the critical issues is were the lack of staircases. There were only three staircases in each of the towers, as compared to nine in the Empire State Building. And one of the things the recommendations from NIST included says a suggestion that everybody should be able to evacuate a building during an emergency. The prior standard had been a partial evacuation of just the floors nearest some kind of emergency. What that meant is that you didn't have to have space for 25,000 people coming down the stairs at once. And you only had to have room for maybe 1,000 or 2,000. And so the result is that the staircases in the tower particularly were inadequate to the day. And you know, I think from my research that more staircases surely could have made a difference.
Well, also, as you know, certainly there has been opposition already to the early drafts of these recommendations. Who is opposing them, and is it about money or about practicality or something else?
I think that any kind of engineering decision has to weigh what the cost is of obtaining a benefit. So if you add staircases, you are going to consume rentable space on each and every floor that staircase passes through. That's a loss. It's not only a cost in building additional staircases during the construction process, but it's also a loss of revenue over the life of the building. So that's a consideration of, how big, how many staircases do you really need? And that information, for instance, is not well understood as yet.
Well, Jim Dwyer, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Jim Dwyer is a reporter with the New York Times and author of 102 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Fight to Survive Inside the Twin Towers. He spoke with me from New York. Mammograms, prostate tests, and other preventive health care is meant to keep us well. Conventional medical wisdom says that if you detect the bad things early enough, you can nip them in the bud and enjoy a long, healthy life. Well, not so fast, says tonight's guest, Dr. Norton Hadler. In a provocative book, The Last Well Person, he describes heart bypass surgery as usually a waste of time and says that treatments for breast cancer are frequently ineffective. The eyebrow-raising list goes on. There's a great deal here to digest and consider, and so we're going to do just that. The doctor is in, and you can join the conversation. Has an early screening saved your life? Does this sound like medical heresy or evidence that you need to know? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Hartford, Connecticut, is Dr. Norton Hadler, University Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. He is a practicing rheumatologist and author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. Welcome, Dr. Hadler.
Good evening, Gail.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Pleasure to have you with us, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Doctor.
Good evening.
Dr. Hadler, I want to start with you about, you know, here you are, you have this very conventional medical education, but what you're saying certainly sounds highly unconventional, almost heretical in terms of what we think of as the usual medical advice. Can you give us just a quick line or two about what brought you to this concern about medicine's increasing tendency to, as you say, overtreat and overdiagnose?
Well, I'm not attempting heresy. To the contrary, all I'm attempting to do is to provide an educational resource so that all of us might step back and take a look at the issues that we all hear about that seem to make confusing sense. Like, how can we be an aging population and yet be faced with epidemics of everything known to man? And the way I started this interest was down the street from you. 40-some-odd years ago, as a first-year medical student at Harvard, when George Packer Berry addressed the incoming freshman class. Now, Dean Berry was in his last year of his tenureship as dean and on the threshold of the ripeness of his old age, and he looked out at the class and he said, "The death rate is one per person." Now, that caused me to pause. It's one of my favorite aphorisms. It means that the issue is not death. The issue is the timing of death and the quality of the journey. Now, once you start to think along those lines, you want to know something about how many years are you promised? What is the timing of death? And there's a fairly rich epidemiology that is imperfect, because it need be imperfect given that question, that tends to suggest that we're promised as a species of something approaching 85 years. And that's our life expectancy. And that's our time. And that's what the data looks like. The likelihood of becoming an octogenarian is increasing, but the likelihood of becoming a nonagenarian is not increasing at anywhere near the rate. So that the idealized population will be smiling on their 85th birthday and be bearing many, many diseases, vying to carry them away.
Well, let's look at some specifics if we can. How does this play out, for example, in heart disease?
Well, what you're next asking me is why would one not reach 85 years? Or what's the diagnosis on your death certificate if you don't reach 85 years? Why one would not reach is called all-cause mortality. Do I care what I died from, or do I care when I died? And in fact, there has been a shift in the time of death across the 20th century, so that my chance of having a heart attack at my age is about 30 to 40% less than my father's chance of having a heart attack when he was my age. And if he had one when he was my age, his five-year survival would be about 50%. And if I have one at my age, my five-year survival is about 96%. And that has nothing to do with medical interventions. In fact, I can increase it from 96% to 98% by taking one baby aspirin.
So basically things like bypass surgery or angioplasty, why would those not be worth the effort?
They are not worth the effort from my perspective, and if anyone thinks they are, they need to sit down and look at the data that suggests they're worth the effort. Most of the data is now several decades old, but these were trials with large numbers of people followed for as long as a decade, comparing people who had bypass surgery with people who were treated medically, and our ability to treat medically has changed. So this was treated medically 20 years ago, and with the exception of one small subset, there is no compelling data that you were better off in any sense for the bypass surgery. And most of the angioplasty has been compared to the bypass surgery, and the data suggests that it's no better.
Let me ask you to hold that thought, because there's clearly a lot more to talk about here. We're talking this hour about a new prescription for a healthier America through less medical intervention. Can you imagine skipping your annual mammogram? Do screenings promise more than they can deliver? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with Dr. Norton Hadler about his provocative prescription for a healthier America through less medical intervention. Do you demand tests when you go to the doctor, or do you think your doctor orders too many tests? Are we all becoming a nation of hypochondriacs? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Dr. Norton Hadler, University Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina and a practicing rheumatologist. He's the author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. And Jack, I want to bring you into the conversation. It does sound counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I speak as one who got his medical degree at Walmart. So, but I think I have a layman's feeling about human nature. And it seems to me that Dr. Hadler posits as the sort of norm, the hypochondriac, the patient who embraces what he calls the suffering, because the doctor says, there is something wrong with your back. You are going to be a patient, and therefore all the worry and concern and so on gets funneled into this syndrome of this negative syndrome. Well, there's another way of looking at it. Fear can also get translated into delay. And it seems to me that in a nation with 40 million people uninsured, procrastination is one of the leading risk factors for disease. We all live with that terror that we go into the doctor and he says, if you had only come in to see me earlier, we could have spotted this. We could have. And why didn't you come in? For many people, it's because of the whole issue of not having the money. For others, it's the way their fear manifests itself. And what I fear when I hear brilliant men with these theories is that some poor bloke out there is going to say, gee, I just heard this wise doctor on the radio saying, a lot of life's maladies just have to be born with, and I think I'll just bear with mine a little more. And then he goes to the doctor and he said, if you would only come in to see me earlier.
Dr. Hadler?
Well, there are many issues you've raised in that one set of comments. One relates to what is the role of the physician in our society, and I've been teaching for years that it is the role of wise counsel, and that you should have no compunctions about going to a physician with your concerns, your anxieties, including the question, am I worried for no good reason that relates to my organ system function, or am I worried for good reasons that relate either to my organ system function or the context in which I am living? That ought to be easy access and paid for by any intelligent, rational healthcare delivery system. So we have no argument there, and there should be no fear in seeking counsel. And that's not what we were talking about. We were talking about the issue of, are we being, in this country, offered a set of remedies that we do extremely well, that if we had stepped back and asked how much benefit do they afford me, we might have questioned whether or not they would have been an option we would take. So the distinction is not stay away from the doctor and die at home. That's not what we're advocating in the least. What we're advocating is that when you approach the healthcare delivery system, so-called, in this country, you do so with a fair amount of sophistication and education, because there are many things that require your active judgment as to whether or not you want to participate.
Well, one of your most controversial assertions, Dr. Hedler, is about mammography, which you say produces almost nothing of value. That's certainly startling news to a lot of women who have had it drilled into them for years that you've got to get screened every single year, or otherwise you are just taking unacceptable risks and being, you know, completely reckless.
Well, we're talking about screening mammography in well women. And in the book and elsewhere, I could talk to you about why this is a blunt instrument. But in fact, we have three randomized controlled trials. And when I say that, I'm talking about major investments. The Canadian trial enrolled 50,000 women in their 40s and 40,000 women in their 50s, and they randomized them to mammography or not, and they followed them up for over a decade, and they didn't save a single life. And in fact, in the 40-year-old inception cohort, they didn't even detect any more cancer. And in the 50-year-old inception cohort, the difference in detection of invasive carcinoma was 12 cases over the course of 13 years for 40,000 women. Now, the downside is, first of all, I'm not sure we can find 12 cases again. That's a very tiny number. That may have happened by chance, by some randomization event. Secondly, it's not just the experience of the mammography, but it's the tremendous number of false positives. So it's this enormous epidemic of biopsies that's going on in this country. And the most yield you can talk about is 12 out of 40,000 and no lives saved. And there's a study of similar size from Malmo in Sweden, another one from Stockholm of similar size, that essentially show the same thing. So I have no problem with any woman deciding she wants screening mammography. There is nothing wrong with her. She has no questions, but she's going to go with some periodicity to have mammograms. That's her choice, but in our country, her choice. But she ought to make that choice, realizing the extraordinarily low yield and the fact that there is a downside. And the downside is, my patients tell me, it's not the most pleasant experience. Nobody finds waiting for the results of a biopsy pleasant, and very few people would volunteer for a low-yield biopsy. So if you have that level of education, you can approach your physician and discuss whether or not mammography makes sense to you. That is not to say that there aren't people who die before their time, and often horribly, from breast cancer, or that I don't consider that a monumental tragedy. All I'm saying is that mammography is a very blunt instrument, and screening programs are very close to a non-start. We need to rethink how we're doing this before we do it, despite the data.
I want to take a couple of quick calls here because we have a couple of people to several of the points you've just made. First to Erie, Pennsylvania. Elizabeth is on the line. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. I just have a point that I want to make, and I think I agree with the doctor. I had a mammography several years ago. The results were perfectly negative, no problems, and of course I have no history of breast cancer. I did routine breast exam monthly, and on a monthly breast exam found a lump, which later proved to be malignant. It was removed. I had negative nodes. I'd done very well. I'm wondering if perhaps rather, and I'd like the doctor's opinion, and I'll hang up and listen to his opinion on air, I'm wondering if perhaps teaching some techniques like this in health recognition, that we could, rather than relying so much on testing, if we could just teach women breast exam, men testicular exams, and things like that. And I'll hang up and listen to his answer on air. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Dr. Hadler?
There have been not only programs to teach women and physicians breast exams, but it's been studied systematically. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. You have to realize there's an enormous false positive rate, so that most lumps that are felt are not cancer. There's also an enormous false negative rate. There's an awful lot of cancer that's missed. So it's not a lot more efficient at finding the evil cancer that's likely to kill you before your time than mammography. Knowing that, it's very hard to tell anyone who feels a lump not to ask their physician, should I worry about this one? Now, that's not screening mammography. That's a specific question about diagnostics. What is this lump? And the lump needs a medical diagnostic evaluation. It may be that the doctor says that's very cystic feeling and I'm going to just watch it, or it may be they'll aspirate it, or it may be they'll image it, or it may be they'll biopsy it. But those are difficult clinical judgments that no one should try to make in the privacy of their home. That requires an interaction with a wise and trusted physician.
I want to take a couple of more calls, and then we'll turn the discussion a little bit to a couple of other issues. But first, I want to hear from Arlette, who's on the line from New York, and hear your story.
Yes, well, I just wanted to give great kudos to Dr. Hadler. I'm so grateful, because I've always had an instinctive feeling that in view, I'm 58, and I've had maybe two or three in my life of mammograms, and I just had an instinctive feeling that subjecting oneself to such radiation anyway, even though the doctors say that it's not all that much, but it seemed to me rather pointless. I actually went under the knife a few years ago. Some doctor thought that I had there was something so minute that they had to explore it and do a biopsy, and it was gruesome. It was, they so much couldn't find it that they took so many mammograms and so many pictures until they found absolutely nothing, and I swore that this would just be the last time.
Arlette, anyway, thank you very much for the call. We have to go quickly now to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Isabel is on the line. Isabel, share your story, if you will.
Well, I happen to know Dr. Hadler, but not in a medical sense. And I have always gone to UNC's hospitals and had my mammograms for many years. And at the age of 59, I detected myself that I thought I had something very wrong, and it turned out that I did have breast cancer, and all of my nodes were cancerous as well. And I had, for every year from the time I was 50, gone through mammograms at the Leinberger Cancer Center. So I fully agree with him. And I was dumbfounded that this procedure that had always been recommended for women over the age of 50, or if anyone were in jeopardy of getting breast cancer even earlier. So I thank him for speaking out for something that I think has been virtually, for me, quite worthless.
Isabel, thanks so much for the call. And I want to go now, bring into the conversation from Houston, Texas, Dr. Teresa Beavers. She is Medical Director of Clinical Cancer Prevention and Prevention Outreach Programs at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Dr. Beavers, welcome to you. And where do you think this makes sense, and where do you perhaps part company with Dr. Hadler?
Well, I'm a little late to joining the program. I apologize. I've actually been tied up with patients, so I haven't been a part of the whole discussion. I do think that there is a role for screening. I don't think it is appropriate for every woman, and I'm the first to admit that. I don't think that every screening test is appropriate for everybody. I think that he and I would actually find a lot of points in common, that we agree that screening is overdone. Too many tests are being recommended that have no proven value. But I will differ a little bit in regards to mammography. I do think that there is some benefit for selected women.
Do you worry that overall the medical industry is turning perfectly healthy people into hypochondriacs?
I think that that is a possibility. I think that many people have a much greater assessment of the risk. I can only personally talk about cancer because that's my particular area of clinical and research focus, but I think that that's probably true. I know I see many women who come in and way overestimate the risk of developing breast cancer. And in fact, when we talk about it, we in fact find that they're not at increased risk, they're in fact at average risk.
Well, and isn't that always the challenge here? I mean, even if it's only 5%, let's say, of people who are at risk who benefit from screening, if you're one of those 5%, you sure want to be having the screening.
Oh, definitely. And I think that recognizing that in the process of screening, we're going to be screening many, many, many individuals who will never in their lifetime experience that particular problem. We have to recognize that there are going to be false positives that and false negatives associated with it. That doesn't mean necessarily that we should give up on a screening test.
So, Dr. Hadler, back to you. So much for the 5%. Well, what about the 95%?
The 5% is an interesting number. It's one of the numbers that floats around in terms of the risk of breast cancer. It's probably higher than that, the lifetime risk. But as I started this conversation, the issue is not do you get breast cancer. The issue is will you ever know about it? And of this 5 to 10% documented breast cancer incidence, the vast majority of it occurs toward that magic 85 number, and most women would not know about it. In fact, epidemiologically, you can model the data, and I can assure you that if we moved all breasts, all colons, and all prostates at puberty, the population would die at the same age. There would be some outliers who were saved premature death from those particular diseases, but the all-cause mortality would be the same. So the issue is, how do you find the outlier, the individual who is unfortunate enough to develop a breast cancer with a biology that's going to cost them time on this planet? And mammography is extraordinarily blunt at doing that.
Well, let me ask you this. What has the evidence that you've found demonstrated in terms of the best predictors of a long and healthy life?
Well, that's a very robust literature now that we need to talk about more in this country. About 85% of your mortal hazard, 75 to 85% of your mortal hazard lives in two questions. Are you comfortable in your socioeconomic status? And do you like your job? And those two questions are independent risk factors, mortal hazards, if you will, independent of all of the health hazards we've learned about, the health adverse behaviors and the exposures and your cholesterol and so forth. That's in the 20%. So, in fact, if we're talking about what is health, a very difficult construct to define, but if we include in health something about longevity and something about satisfaction with one's place in society, measures like your relative socioeconomic status overwhelm all of these other things we're talking about and are perturbed readily by society in ways that we can measure the outcome. For example, one of the biggest hazards to your health in contemporary America is this wonderful thing called downsizing. There are now several cohort studies where large groups of workers have lived through downsizing and their health goes down very rapidly and easily measured. In fact, if you look at the longevity of Russia...
Have to stop you there, if you will. We'll pick up on that point when we come back in just a moment. Also want to thank Dr. Teresa Beavers for being with us. Thanks, Doctor.
Yes.
She's Medical Director of Clinical Cancer Prevention at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with Dr. Norton Hadler about his provocative prescription for a healthy America with a lot less medical testing. Have we turned growing older into a disease? Are we becoming a nation of the people who are worried sick? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest this evening is Dr. Norton Hadler, author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly, is with us. I want to quickly go to our phone lines. Raleigh, North Carolina, Jennifer's on the line. Hello, Jennifer.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Now I believe we can.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a point that I'm so a doctor actually say what my instincts have told me for years. My parents are in their 70s and live.
I'm sorry, Jennifer. We seem to have lost you. The point I believe that she was going to make was that her parents seem to live at the doctor's office. And Dr. Hadler, let me put that to you as to what the downside is here of becoming a patient, to thinking that you know at any moment your body might trip you up, so you're going to have to be there all the time and undergo all kinds of tests to make sure that things are happening the way they're supposed to.
Well, this is a phenomenon called medicalization. And it's not... this is not casting aspersions on my profession or on our culture, but it is very much part of the culture of this country and several others. We have this notion that, as I said, you may have been promised 85 years, but don't for one minute think that you're promised 85 years without predicaments of life. There'll be headache and heartache and backache and neck pain, and they'll come repeatedly, and so will blue days, and so will happy days. And if there is a rattling of your sense of invincibility for whatever reason, then it ought to be possible to go to a wise counselor, perhaps a physician, and ask, is this predicament reflecting something that I need to be concerned in terms of my biology, or is it reflecting something that I need to be concerned in terms of the context of my living, or both? And in our country, it is very hard for the American to hear and very hard for the American physician to say, I think this is reflecting something about the context of your living, that you're having trouble with this predicament, whereas you didn't last year. In our society, we hear that kind of assertion as somebody said, it's in my mind, and we get furious. And if we would do much better if we were able to say, you mean it's in my mind? That's good news. That's a lot better than kidney failure or leukemia, isn't it? And we can't do that. So the result is we go to the doctor having done our differential diagnosis and read so many magazines and tried to figure out why this backache or this bellyache or this headache hasn't gone away, and the doctor is expected to find the cause. And we are pretty inventive at looking at potential causes, and we are willing to state that I'm not sure this is the cause, but it might be. And that's called medicalization.
Jack Beatty, you've been waiting very patiently here. I apologize. We've covered a lot of ground since we heard from you, and I want to invite you to speak to whichever piece of this you'd like to.
Well, I think it's fascinating. But, you know, let's look at depression. That's a major undertreated illness. Studies are that something like 40% of the people who have it never get treated for it. Why? One reason is resignation. One reason is they accept what sounds like wisdom, that life is full of suffering and that it's their lot to suffer in this particular way. And in that strange way, the stoicism that we admire in human nature, and that I hear the doctor calling on us to display, works against people, works to make suffering exorbitant, and increases the weight of that gratuitous and remediable suffering on people by really kind of making them this is what life is. And that's what worries me about this line of thinking. Obviously, he's right about these tests and so on, but if you start to really take this in, I just hear premature resignation here.
Well, you're hearing things that I'm not saying. There are people who would like me to do another Last Well Person with 10 more chapters, and one of them would be the difference between depression in lowercase and depression in uppercase. Depression in lowercase is indeed something that all of us will have. Some of us will have more than others. Often it's reactive to some of life's dirty tricks. It responds terribly to pharmaceuticals, which is what most Americans think of as under treatment, and which is what most of the press has been on under treatment. It does respond to effective talk therapy from trained people, because sometimes we do need help. Sometimes we can't think our way out of why we feel so powerless at this time in our life. So I fully agree with you that there is undertreatment, but the undertreatment of depression in lowercase, which is the commonest depression, the predicaments of life that can be really quite overwhelming and incapacitating, but do not respond to SSRIs, and there are multiple randomized controlled trials showing that they respond no better than placebo. But we think respond to talk therapists. Now, that could be whoever it is that you find most effective, and whoever it is that has the background and the perspective that you feel will be most useful to you. It could be your primary care physician. It could be a social worker. It could be a clergyman. But not for one minute should our society say, just tough it out. No one is advocating that. What we're advocating is, let's use the science we have to inform your decisions and to inform your conversation with your provider of care. If you have biological depression, this comes out of the blue and can be a major catastrophic illness, then there's a role for some pharmaceuticals. And the distinction is usually made by somebody who's trained in the ability to make that distinction. And the answer to this country is not to put Prozac in the reservoir.
To Nahant now. Paul's on the line. Hello, Paul.
Yes. I tuned into your show a little bit late, so I don't know what transpired in the first 25 minutes. I'm a radiologist, and for your listeners, we are the subspecialty in medicine who read the great bulk of mammograms. My own bias is very much in sympathy with the physician who's doing most of the talking tonight. I think we do too much testing. We do too much screening. Spend a lot of money on treating very arcane illnesses and don't pay enough attention to lifestyle issues and diet and general mental health. And but given that, I have to say that I'm surprised and very disappointed that the discussion about mammography presented only one side of what is a very well-joined controversy in medicine today. And there is a ton of evidence which controverts what we've heard tonight. Now, I'm not well-versed enough in it to present chapter and verse to refute what I've heard, or at least to give additional perspective on it. But there are people who have been appropriate to join the discussion tonight, and it's a very irresponsible approach taken by your producer and your show in setting up the discussion in such a one-sided fashion.
Paul, were you with us when Dr. Beavers was with us?
Oh, she barely scratched the surface. I mean, first of all, she didn't hear what had been said previously, and she didn't speak to it cogently. And secondly, there are many people who have a much stronger bias toward screening in specific populations or screening in the population at large. There's a ton of evidence that really should have been presented, and by only presenting what I feel is...
Paul, I think we got you on that point, but we're running short on time. I do want to throw that back to Dr. Hadler.
Let me respond briefly, because this is not an exercise, in my opinion. You're right, there is a ton of evidence. Most of it is low quality, and most of it has been reviewed by as unbiased groups of international epidemiologists as we can mobilize. For example, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is 10,000 international epidemiologists that have now produced almost 2,000 documents on separate issues, mammography being one. And when you look at this enormous amount of data, you come down to the three trials I mentioned. And when you read them carefully and dissect them carefully, what I said actually understated their conclusion. Not only the conclusion of the Cochrane Collaboration, but the conclusion of its principal authors. If there is a debate, it was raised by Ali Mietinen, a Finnish epidemiologist who makes an argument, which if we had time, I would take you through, about maybe there's some advantage for mammography to women when they turn into their late 70s. It's a very tenuous argument. But the argument I gave you is not just mine, and it's not my opinion. It's based on a tremendous amount of effort with this enormous literature.
Dr. Hadler, in the couple of minutes that we have left, I just want to ask if you were surprised when your book got good reviews in both the New England Journal of Medicine and also the Journal of the American Medical Association, because clearly much of what you're saying does sound like heresy.
No, I'm not surprised. The book is not a diatribe, and nor is that my style. The book is an educational exercise, my first book of many, many written for the general audience, where I try to present these concepts and the way you go about understanding them so that you can make up your mind based on what we know. And I chose 10 topics, one of which is titled Screening Mammography and How the Women's Movement Got It Wrong, where I make it very clear that the issue is important. I wish that no woman died before her time of anything, and certainly not of breast cancer. But we're not there yet, and the data says for anyone who takes the time, and it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort to read these studies carefully and deal with the primary data sets and look at the nuances of the data, if you do that, you will come up with the kind of discussion we had and we had with Dr. Beasley, that there is it is very hard for oncologists who have seen tragedy and for radiologists who have felt like a hero when they picked up that cancer to realize that this test is not doing what we think it's doing for the population at large. And they were the women who were saved, if you will, from mammography. That happens by good fortune and not by good science and not because they have a screening instrument that really works.
Well, let's look on the positive side here. Give us a prescription for preventive maintenance. What would that look like to you? Is it the old common sense stuff about keep your weight down, exercise, eat well, all those kinds of things that we've heard about so many times? Is that really the right prescription that
no,
we should be looking at here?
No, all of that's been studied, and that's part of our culture, but not part of our science. BMI, your body mass index, is a risk factor, but not much of one until you're quite obese, and then it becomes a major risk factor. The same thing with redefining your blood sugar as a hazard so that we've now got the majority of the country labeled as diabetics. There is one study that came out recently from a study that went on for over a decade trying to do something about the blood sugars that of people where it was picked up as just part of their screening. And it turns out that they didn't save a life, not even close. They didn't save any major catastrophic event. So, no, these are not, for me, where the issues are. The issues, the primary issues in terms of the health of society, if you will, relate to the brief comment I gave you and that I would love to have time to expand on, which is what do we mean by socioeconomic status? It's not money. It's something about what kind of flow is there to your life, and then the other issues relate to how do you interface with the medical profession when we have so much that works, to know that this is something I need, and in terms of a specific intervention, and this is something I don't need in terms of a specific intervention, and when I don't need it, what are my options? And those are the major issues that relate to the health of society. It's the structure of society and the effective use of medical intervention.
Jack,
not everybody ought to be jumping up and down. I happen to like this cycle, but that's because I like it. It's not because I think I will therefore live longer.
Jack Beatty, does this sound like a healthcare system that might be a little more manageable, a little less expensive?
Well, it does, but you know, we have a healthcare system where, as the doctor says, there are lots of tests used that don't really return on the investment. And on the other hand, we have a huge population of people who never get those tests, and who, when they finally show up at the emergency room or wherever, it's then the heroic measures have to take place, then the heroic surgeries take place, then the costs rise. So the costs rise through unnecessary tests. They also rise hugely through last-minute and heroic measures because people have delayed.
Well, I need to sit down with you one evening and take you through some of those assertions. But the first assertion, which is, can we design a healthcare system that's rational? Yes, we certainly can. We know an awful lot about that. In fact, that's what I'm doing here in Hartford. I seminars with health insurance companies on rethinking the model. It is not even difficult to do. We can provide with far less of the total expenditure, much more rational use of money, most of which ends up in the hands of the individual and in informed individual. The necessary health care cost for disease management in the working age population in our country should approach, this is for disease management, should approach about $500 per capita per year. However, there's a tremendous need for expenditures on health assurance. And health assurance is things like English as a second language and job retraining and your ability to find your place in our very, very difficult society. It's not easy here, and we ought to be able to provide support for that. And it's very easy to model this, and what stops it from happening, aside from a lot of vested interest, which is obvious, but what stops it from happening is the social construction of well-being in our society.
And we have to stop it there. Thanks so much, Dr. Norton Hadler, for being with us, author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. And thanks to you, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Thank you, as always, for being with us.
Thanks.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.